screamed, he reached down and peeled the nylon stocking from the creased and grimacing face. "It's Mr. Haddad," the tellers gasped. In that instant, some said was impulse and others called courage, the blind man's secret was exposed. And so, because he could see, the town felt it no longer owed him anything. There were even people who insisted he had never been blind, that he had hoodwinked everyone for the past 20 years. All the old rumors surfaced, but Joey Selden had caught the imagination of the town's young people. They came nightly to hear the story told and retold. They would ask the same questions. Had he aimed at Haddad's legs? Yes, Joey told them. The only time you aim at a man's heart is when he's aiming at yours. Had he been scared? Not until it was over, and then he couldn't stop shaking. Had it been a conscious decision to pull out the gun and shoot, or had it just happened? Both, he said, with a realization that they were listening as he had for so many years, for more than words could convey. The eviction notice no longer fluttered from the corner post. One of the boys had torn it off and ripped it into tiny pieces. Blue Mooney was released from jail. Sonny tried to apologize, but Mooney pushed past him and kicked open the door. As he stepped into the gray drizzle, he glanced back and swore.
"What you say?"
Officer Hines called after him. The secretary and the other officers watched from their desks. Mooney turned and walked back into the station. He stood in front of Hines.
"Fuck you. That's what I said. But what I meant was fuck all of you. Every single one of you," he said, looking at each of them.
Hines's hand shot out to grab him, but Sonny stopped him.
"Let him be," Sonny said. "That's all he's got right now."
He was right. Mooney only got madder. Everywhere he went, he was turned away. Coulter had hired somebody else and didn't need him. He went up to the A plus X, hoping to see Alice, who was out sick. Carla told him there was some weird story going around about Alice and that priest. In the few minutes he was there, Hines drove through twice in his cruiser, and then Jerry Coughlin told him to leave. Haddad could confess all he wanted, but the shadow that had called Mooney from birth just grew thicker. The accusations only further proof of his badness. His mother wouldn't let him through the door. She had a boyfriend now, a well-respected gentleman who brought her flowers and perfume and candy bars for the boys. He was teaching them how to play golf by letting them caddy for him. He thought selling beer set a terrible example for them, so he was going to get her a waitressing job at the country club. She had met Cleveland Hines when she went into the bank for a car loan. He had not only processed the loan in one day, but had delivered the check himself that very night. The only person glad to see Mooney was Bernadette, even though he hadn't been able to find her engagement ring in the sink trap. A friend of hers needed a truck and a driver to pick up a load of soap next week in Connecticut.
"I'm your man,"
he told her. He didn't have anything else to do. It was early Saturday morning, and the garage felt as close as if all the summer's heat were in storage here. Marie wanted to haul the junk inside to the dump, but without a car that was impossible. Norm's car was next to the garage with the hood up. He worked on it every day after work, but all he seemed to be doing was dismantling the engine. There were parts lined up on the fender, and some had fallen into the grass. She dragged a moldy braided rug into the driveway. Most of this junk had been here when she had moved in. If it weren't for the soap coming next week, she wouldn't be doing this now with the million and one other things she had to do. Damn, where was everyone? She ran into the house and yelled up the stairs for the third time for them to get out there and help her this minute. No ifs, ands, or buts, goddammit. Footsteps moved overhead. Doors opened. She went back out and decided to move most of this stuff out of the way until they could get it to the dump. She began to slide boxes onto the back floor of Norm's car. She even jammed newspapers and a smelly old shoe under the front seat. In no time at all, she had filled the trunk and every inch of his car with just enough space left for the driver. There. She shoved in 5 cans of paint.
"What are you doing?"
Norm said as she was forcing the door closed. "This way, when the car's fixed, all you have to do is go to the dump," she said.
"I can't believe you put all that junk in my car, Mom."
He threw up his hands and his voice cracked.
"I can't believe some of the things you do."
"He'll be a good man when he grows up," she thought, as startled by the realization as by this surge of happiness. "I'm sorry," she said. "It just
seemed like such a good idea. Once I got started, I couldn't stop.
Looking at the packed car now, she burst out laughing.
Look what she did,
Norm said to his sister and brother, who had just come outside.
She turned me into the pig man, Grandine Carson.
Now they were all laughing, even Alice with her hollow eyes. She had lost weight, and her hair was dull and stringy. She and Marie still hadn't really talked about what had happened. Alice spent most of her time in her room, which spared Marie the guilt of having to face her own failure.
I know, Benji said. You can just have it towed out of here, junk and all. What do you mean, towed? Look, I'm in the middle of fixing it. I got everything all laid out.
Admit it, Norm. You have no idea what any of these parts do, Alice said, her gaunt smile catalyst enough for them to move around the front of the car, holding up parts for Norm to identify.
That's a... I forget the name.
Oh, great, Norm, Benji said.
But it has something to do with the motor, Marie laughed.
Very good, Norm.
No, no, no. It's part of the carburetor, he said.
And where's that? Alice asked. Norm dropped to his knees.
Let's see, it's around here somewhere, he said, feeling through the tall grass and peering under the car while they laughed.
Marie's eyes met Alice's. They would talk later, after the soap had come, and she could think straight. By the time Omar arrived, they had almost emptied the garage. They had dragged the washing machine box behind Norm's car, and they were filling it with old screens and the bug-infested firewood from the back wall of the garage. Omar was in the house, making phone calls to set up deliveries. Marie had been shocked at the long list of numbers. They were all local calls, he assured her.
You mean Atkinson? You mean all those people are going to be selling Presto here in Atkinson? She asked.
Just one or two are deliveries, he said. The rest are potential customers for you. I thought I'd drop off samples.
Norm and Benji were still carrying out firewood. Alice was attempting to make shelves with a few warped boards and old bricks. It wobbled, so she took it apart and restacked the bricks. Her determination pleased Marie. Work had always been her own best therapy. Tomorrow she'd tell her that there'd be no more hiding up there in her room. The hell with what anyone thought. She had to get back to work and earn as much as she could in these last 2 weeks before school. She went into the house for rags so she could wash the garage windows. Omar covered the telephone mouthpiece.
Customer,
he whispered, winking. She patted his cheek, and as he bent toward her, she thought she heard the dial tone.
Well, you'll certainly get an invitation to one of the soap parties then, Mr. Clyde, he said,
and she knew she'd been mistaken.
I don't know of another cleansing agent like it,
he was saying as she came outside.
Mom!
Norm warned as she headed toward the garage. She stopped at the doorway when she realized someone was in there with Alice.
Please, Alice, please, I need to see you. We have to talk. Please, just come in the car with me,
Father Gannon pleaded. He hadn't shaved, and his eyes were sunken in dark circles. Alice stood before him, eyes closed, head down, her arms folded tightly across her chest.
No,
she said in a small voice.
Please, I can't stand this anymore,
he begged.
And neither can she, Marie said, so leave her alone.
Mrs. Vermoyle, he said, spinning around, you don't understand.
He held out his hand as if for hers.
I understand. I understand plenty. You should be ashamed of yourself, a priest.
I am, he cried. I am ashamed, but not because I love Alice. I just can't stand it that she's been hurt like this.
Then leave her alone. Walk out of here. Go. She doesn't want to see you.
She gestured to Alice, who was crying, her face buried in her hands.
Alice?
He reached to touch her arm.
Let me help you.
No,
Alice whispered, shrinking away.
Haven't you done enough harm? Marie said.
Alice, look at me. I'm falling apart. I don't know what to do,
he panted, pacing back and forth, running his hands through his hair.
Tell me what to do. Please, please, please tell me.
Alice wouldn't look at him. Marie held her breath, afraid his inferno would consume the hesitant flicker of Alice's resolve. She looked back as Omar came through the doorway.
I just want to be with you. Is that so wrong? Tell me, is that so bad? I'll do anything. Whatever you say. What? What is it you want?
He cried, ripping off the stiff white collar and flinging it to the ground. He brought his foot down, stomping as if on some verminous creature he needed to obliterate.
There,
There, is that what you want?
She stood between him and Alice.
Father,
Omar said, placing his hand on the priest's heaving shoulder,
you are out of control. You are harassing this child. You are tormenting her, and I will not allow it for one more moment. You hear me now?
I love her.
Then leave her alone.
I'm sorry, he kept saying, as Omar walked him to the car. Marie went into the house, sick to her stomach and angry for what he had done to Alice, who was curled up in her bed again with the shades drawn and the sheet over her head. She picked up the phone and called the rectory. When she said her name, the Monsignor said,
Yes, what is it, Mrs. Vermoyle?
I'll tell you what it is, she growled into the phone so Alice couldn't hear, so that Alice could hear, wishing both to protect her and yet to emphasize the vile one-sidedness of sex with the humiliation and suffering it caused a woman. It's not only a sin what's happened here, Monsignor, but a crime. My daughter is only 17, and your priest is an adult. I'm warning you, if he comes back here, I'll call the police.
Oh, God, oh, God, oh, God,
Alice moaned in her room. Norm went into her, then Benji, and now Marie. She sat on the edge of the bed and tried to hold her, but Alice stiffened away. It just wasn't fair. It wasn't right, especially now when she was so close to finally being able to give them a better life after so many years of scrimping by and being scared. She touched Alice's sweaty head. Alice curled forward until her hand fell away.
Is that it?
She wondered, her ears ringing with the old rage.
You don't want things to change, do you? It's easier to hide, isn't it, and never face up to anything. Well, God damn it, no matter how bad things got, I could never hide. No one ever took care of me while I whimpered in my bed. No, sir, no one ever did, she panted, trying to pull her up.
Alice's chest heaved up and down. She was gasping. Her eyes were bulging.
What? Say it. What is it? Marie demanded. Tell me.
She was conscious now of Omar behind her.
Let her be,
he said softly.
Say it,
she cried.
What's wrong with me? What's wrong with me? Oh, God, what's wrong with me?
Alice was moaning.
Self-pity,
she hissed over the bed.
That's what's wrong. That's all that's wrong. Oh, God, God, God.
Alice pummeled her own chest with blows that were sickeningly loud. Omar grabbed Alice's wrists, and she froze so rigidly her back appeared to arch. Marie closed her eyes.
No,
said Omar, his voice soothing but emphatic.
There is no wrong here, child. I know. I know how it goes. I know how it went. There's only goodness in you and love, and came a moment in your faith and trust when you were asked for more, more than you should have been, and you did not turn away, because you are an innocent. You gave, and in the giving you were taken advantage of. Why, in the very asking you were taken advantage of, nothing's going to change what happened, but that happened to a different person. You're someone else now, Alice Vermoyle. Don't you see? You're a brand new person now.
In the hallway, Marie covered her mouth so they wouldn't hear her cry. Thank God for Omar, she thought. She just couldn't do it alone anymore. That night, Alice dreamed that she was on television. Sitting at a table in front of thousands of people, there were three of her. There was a glass of red wine in front of each contestant.
Will the real Alice Vermoyle please stand up? The host called into the microphone.
The audience clapped. She looked down at the other two Alices. They looked at each other, then back at her.
Will the real Alice Vermoyle please stand up?
The host urged with an impatient gesture. They each started to get up, then hesitated at seeing each other rising, then quickly sat back down again.
I repeat, will the real Alice Vermoyle please stand up?
They rose in unison, standing while the audience hissed and booed. The announcer snatched up their papers, wine glasses, and microphones.
I'm sorry, he said, turning back to the angry audience. There's been a terrible, terrible mistake.
The weekend was dragging by. Every time Norm looked out the window, he saw his car filled with junk, all that crap piled to the roof for Duval's sake. He was everywhere. The kitchen table was covered with Presto order forms and pamphlets. His razor was on the back of the sink. his black hairs clogging the drain. On Saturday night, Norm walked all the way to the Millers. Weeb's sister, Janice, left the room when he came in. It was the first time he'd seen her since that night at the lake. "Barf time," Weeb grunted, making it to the couch on his crutches. Norm asked if she was sick, and Weeb grumbled something about her always being sick.
"What do you mean, always sick?"
Norm asked, and Weeb said it was nothing, never mind.
"No," he insisted. "Tell me. Tell me what you meant."
"I didn't mean anything," Weeb said, looking at him.
"Yes, you did. You said she's sick all the time."
"What?
What do you care?
You getting weird or something, Norm?" Weeb said, his voice cracking. They watched television for a little while, and then Norm headed back home. Not having a car was humiliating. It was embarrassing to be seen walking all over town. He felt like Howard Menka. On his way home, he passed by the industrial park. Curious, he went in and roamed around until he came to the Brace Paper Division building. He considered knocking on the door and saying hello to his father. If he was here, he'd be sober. He hadn't seen him since graduation night. Standing under the bright streetlight, he thought of the men he worked with and how proud they were of their kids. Kenny Doyle, who was the toughest man he'd ever known, stopped on his way home every Friday night to buy ice cream and root beer for his five kids. But Kenny was a good guy, and his father was an asshole, so why waste time on a lost cause? Relieved that he'd talked himself out of it, he went home. On Monday, he got to work 20 minutes early. The town barn stank of grease and fertilizer. The men said that on one of these hot days, the place was going to explode. The barn was actually an airplane hangar, government surplus the town had purchased right after the war to garage its street department trucks and heavy equipment. Jardin Green was in his office, berating Leo, a shy, soft-spoken man who'd been the department's head gardener for 20 years.
"Don't tell me the fuck about elms!"
Green's voice rose, and the men looked up from their coffee.
"Yeah, don't tell him the fuck about nothing," Kenny Doyle said in a low voice, "'cause that's what he knows best."
Their heads bobbed with swallowed laughter, and once again Norm felt proud that Kenny had chosen him for his crew. Kenny believed in fair play. He watched out for the little guy. He was tough and wise as hell, and every man here respected him. The office door opened, and Leo scurried out with his head down. Green followed, clapping his hands for everyone to get up.
"Let's get a move on now. Come on, come on,"
he ordered, going out to the trucks.
"Pompous little asshole," Kenny muttered as he walked to the back of the truck with his hand on Norm's shoulder.
That evening, Kenny let Norm stay on for the weekly poker game in the foreman's cramped office. His job was to fetch beers and keep an eye out for surprise visitors, namely Greeny. He stood by the window behind Kenny, his heart sinking with every lousy hand. Talk about bad luck. At one point, Kenny had lost $50. Now Norm was lighting one cigarette off the other as he peered down through the wafting blue haze of cigar and cigarette smoke. $65. The pile of bills grew in front of Lonzo Thayer, who had stripped down to his undershirt. Lonzo Thayer didn't work here, but it was obvious he often played cards with the men. Norm didn't know how much Kenny made, but he was sure $65 had to be a week's pay. On this hand, Kenny lost $8 more.
"Last hand,"
Lonzo announced. Norm passed each man another beer, but he deliberately skipped Kenny.
"Hey, Norm, am I that much of a loser?"
Kenny called, gesturing impatiently until Norm gave him a beer.
"Tonight you are,"
Lonzo laughed.
"Tough luck,"
Ed Jessings said.
"Hey,"
Kenny said, wiping his mouth after a long guzzle.
"Come see, come saw, you know."
"It's not right,"
Norm thought as Lonzo shuffled the cards. Wetting his fingers, he began to deal, snapping each card onto the table. Kenny finished his beer. His hand was pathetic. His face was red, and he kept blowing out of his mouth as if he were trying to cool off.
"Give me a bud, Norm."
He held his hand back for the cold, wet bottle. It was his 10th beer. Jesus Christ, the man was destroying himself. How many times had men handed his father another beer, another shot, another slug? Of course, the difference was his father would be wiped out by the third round, and all Kenny had was a red face and no money. He'd just lost again. Norm watched Lonzo's manicured nails tuck the bills into his thick black wallet, which he set on the table. This was nothing to him. He probably did this every night of the week. Norm thought of Kenny's five little kids and his pretty pregnant wife. Jesus Christ,
Didn't Lonzo or any of them care? They were talking about the pennant race. He couldn't believe what he was hearing. Lonzo was worried about the Yankees and Bobby Shantz's arm, and Kenny's kids were probably going to be hungry all next week. Lonzo stood up, and as he reached for his shirt on the back of the chair, Norm was shocked to see the butt of a gun in his pocket. That explained everything. Thayer was a crook, a gangster. From outside now came a loud banging sound, then headlights filled the window.
Jesus Christ! Shit! Turn out the light!
The room went dark as the men crowded around the window.
It's a green Buick,
someone hissed.
Let me see,
Lonzo said, pushing to get near. Norm's hands groped on the table for Lonzo Thayer's wallet. No time for counting. He slipped a thickness of bills into his pocket, then refolded the wallet and stepped among the gaping men.
Just Parker's,
said Charlie Puleo with a sigh of relief as the car pulled off the road and the headlights went out.
Jesus Christ,
Lonzo kept groaning, even when the lights came back on.
When I heard green Buick, I almost shit. Why? What's a green Buick, undercover?
Asked Charlie Puleo, his eyes gleaming with admiration for slick Lonzo.
No, worse, my wife,
Lonzo said, and the men all laughed. He slipped the wallet into his back pocket, then buttoned the loop. Norm felt dizzy. He could barely breathe, he was so nervous. He staggered a little when he stepped into the pure night air.
You been drinking, kid?
Kenny eyed him suspiciously over the wheel as he started the car.
No. That's good.
They drove in silence. They were halfway across town when Kenny sighed and kept tapping the wheel with his fist.
Oh, Jesus Christ,
he said under his breath.
I really took a beating tonight, didn't I?
He tried to laugh. Instead, had to keep clearing his wheezy throat. He pulled into Norm's driveway.
See you tomorrow, kid.
He gave him a jab in the shoulder.
Here,
Norm said, tossing the bills at him before he closed the door.
Norm,
Kenny called him back.
Where the hell'd you get this?
He kept looking at the money, and then at Norm.
From that fucking Lonzo,
Norm said, his heart finally beating.
Norm, you shouldn't have done that. Jesus Christ, that was stupid. I can't believe you did that. But it's your money. It was all you had, and that fucking Lonzo, he's a crook. He had a fucking gun.
Kenny covered his eyes with the bills and groaned.
Lonzo's a trooper, Norm. He's a fucking state trooper.
The next morning, the crew was in high spirits. Jardin Green had come down to the truck barn with coffee and donuts for everyone. Norm was relieved when Kenny sat next to him on the bench. He'd been awake most of the night, replaying in agonizing detail every stupid move of his life, getting thrown off the baseball team, beating up Billy Hendricks, getting slobbering drunk with Janice Miller, and then, last night, Jesus, it was like having this crazy jack-in-the-box tucked in his brain, and right when it seemed things couldn't get any better, out he'd spring to screw everything all up.
Here,
Kenny said, offering him another donut. Norm thanked him. He ate it in miserable silence, awaiting his bitter pill. And as sure as he knew Kenny, he knew it was coming. Kenny would insist that the money be returned to Lonzo, which he'd already made up his mind to do, with or without Kenny. But in his most optimistic scenario, it was the two of them meeting Lonzo somewhere by the side of the road, sitting in the trooper's cruiser, telling it straight, black and white, no excuses, just the facts, setting it right like a man. Jesus. It wasn't easy, learning this all on his own, not from any father or uncle, but from so much constant watching and listening that sometimes he felt like a goddamn spy out here in the world, an actor in constant rehearsal for the big performance. Kenny and Whitey Martin were laughing at Jardin Green's khaki shirt.
How many fucking pockets he got in that shirt?
Asked Martin under his breath.
When's the fucking safari starting? That's what I want to know,
Ed Jessing said as Green headed out to the trucks. The men hurried to finish their coffee. Kenny stood up.
But?
He held out his pack. Norm took one, and Kenny lit it for him. He took a deep drag. Now, he told himself, have some balls. Say it now.
Hey, Kenny,
he called, as Kenny started for the door.
You know, last night, what I did with the money and everything? Well, I want you to know.
Kenny gripped his shoulder hard at Whitey Martin's approach.
Don't worry about it. No, but I forgotten. Yeah, but... Didn't happen.
Kenny snapped his fingers.
A little amnesia goes a long way, kid.
He winked.
A long, safe way.
They piled into two trucks with Jardin Green in the lead cab, his arm out the window, his smooth head gleaming through the dusty glass. The heat prickled Norm's face, and it felt good. The men squinted into the early morning sun as the old trucks lumbered through town. Horns tooted here and there, and people waved from the sidewalks. When a worker spotted a buddy, he called out his name.
"Hey, Bopper!"
And everyone on the truck hollered the name after him.
"Hey, Bop!
How's it going, Bop?"
Norm smiled. These were good men, and Kenny was the best of the bunch. In the distance, a man turned the corner. He was slightly built, but the familiar hunch of his tense shoulders was like seeing a reflection. He wore coveralls, and he carried a black lunch pail. Norm was relieved at the steady stride. The trucks came alongside, and none of the men called out, though many had known Sam Vermoil all their lives.
"Didn't you see him?"
Kenny called over the creaking rumble.
"Huh?"
Norm looked up, then back at Kenny.
"Your father. He was waving at you,"
Kenny said.
"Where?"
"Oh, I didn't see him," Norm said, craning his neck now, peering back into the distance.
"I figured you didn't,"
Kenny said, watching him. As they came up the hill toward the park, Joey was outside his stand stacking soda cases. When he saw them, he hurried inside, fumbling to padlock the door behind him. The lead truck drove over the curb onto the sidewalk and parked in front of the stand. Jardin Green jumped out and stood talking to Joey. Both men's arms were folded, their expressions grim. In the trucks, the crews leaned over the sides, watching.
"He's not doing what I think he's doing,"
Whitey Martin said as Green held out a typed form that Joey refused to take.
"Sure looks like it," said Jessing.
Green kept stabbing his finger at Joey's face as he tried to make his point.
"Little asshole better watch out," said Charlie Rideros. "Joey's liable to plug him." "They already took his gun. Sonny's got it,"
said Whitey Martin. His nephew was Jimmy Hines, the cop.
"That's too bad," said Jessing.
Joey's voice rose angrily as he kept insisting his dealings were with the town and not with Green, who had no jurisdiction here and no power over him.
"You're in violation. You've been condemned."
Again, Green shook the paper.
"And this permit allows me to raise this structure,"
Green cried, shaking a corner post so that the whole stand shook.
"Get the hell out of here, Green. I'm warning you,"
Joey said, raising his fist.
"Holy shit,"
groaned Kenny, as Green reached up and pulled down the faded red and white sign with its popped kernels that the elements had muted to fluffy little clouds. The signboard swung on one nail, back and forth, as if timing the moment of shocked silence between the two men. Across the street, the pharmacy door opened, and Marco came onto the steps, wiping his hands on a white towel. Joey shouted that his lease wasn't up until next spring.
"Lease? You broke the lease,"
Green hooted,
"and so now there is no lease."
Norm looked at Kenny, who was lighting a cigarette.
"How'd he break the lease?"
"By letting the place get like that,"
Kenny said with a nod.
"But that's not fair. Greeny wouldn't let us fix it,"
Norm sputtered.
"And Joey couldn't. Jesus, he was blind."
"And now he can see,"
said Whitey with a shrug.
"Amen."
"Well, he's still blind as far as I'm concerned,"
said Leo softly.
"Yeah," said Norm. "That's right."
"I heard it ain't that much sight he's got back anyway,"
said Charlie Rideros.
"Yeah," said Norm. "That's what I heard too."
He hadn't heard anything of the kind, but Joey needed all the help he could get.
"He's nothing but an asshole,"
Kenny said, turning his back on the argument below. Norm turned too. Good. Let Greeny know how everyone felt.
"Uh-oh, here we go," warned Jessing.
Jardin Green was ordering them down from the trucks.
"Where are they going?"
Norm asked Kenny as the men climbed out one by one.
"Come on,"
Kenny snapped, then jumped onto the street. The last man in the truck, Norm, paused, then jumped out.
"Hi, Joey,"
he said when he was next to the stand. But Joey stared fiercely past him, his chin trembling as Green ordered the entire stand dismantled. The men stood in a half circle, their eyes on the ground. Green clapped his hands.
"There's a job to be done, men, so let's get to it."
Not a man moved. Norm chewed his lip to hide his glee. "Forget it, Greeny."
"What? Was there some kind of vote or something?"
asked Charlie Rideros.
"The alderman's meeting last night. They want him out of here. That was the vote, so out he goes."
Green wiped his hands together, as if wiping them of dust.
"But what'll he do?" asked Kenny. "You're asking us to tear down a man's livelihood."
"Yeah,"
said Jessing.
A man's livelihood, yeah. Livelihood. Let me tell you something.
Green stepped closer.
That old buzzard has made more money off that stand than all of us put together. He's loaded, and don't let anybody tell you different.
Jesus, Kenny said, shaking his head. I've known Joey all my life. We all have. Green was growing impatient. They had no choice. They were town employees, and the town fathers wanted this eyesore removed. Besides, he confided, again stepping closer, they'd be doing Joey a favor. The old man was out of control, carrying a gun and shooting people. Robert Haddad was still in the hospital. A bank robber, Norm expected someone to point out, but no one did. They sighed and fumbled in their pockets and scratched heads and, muttering, dug their boot toes into the ground. Norm clenched his teeth. Never had he felt prouder. This was guts, and he was privileged to be part of it.
What? Asked Green, looking each man in the eye. You think you're going to tell me no, and then what? You're just going to pile back on the truck, and that's it?
Uh-huh.
You can tell me no, but then you're done. As long as you understand that, then you can do whatever the hell you want.
He turned and rushed at the stand, yanking the stilled sign from its nail. He tossed it into the back of the truck, then raced back to face them. There was a crowbar in his hand. Again, he ordered them to work, but no one moved.
It's not worth it, he warned, so angry he was panting. Take my word for it!
He raced toward the stand, and it sickened Norm the way Joey flinched, shoulder and arm raised as if to ward off a blow. Green rammed the crowbar into the counter, then pried up a board with a squeal of wrenched nails. Joey reached for the board, but Green threw it down. Now he banged on the corner post, trying to loosen the crosshatch of braced boards. One by one, he tossed them to the ground, and then the roof began to sag. Norm couldn't believe they could just stand there watching this pathetic scene.
Somebody's got to do something, he said to Kenny, who sighed. Jesus Christ, said Whitey Martin, stepping forward. Come on, Joey, this has gone far enough now. Get the hell out of there, now, before you get hurt.
He was kicking the locked door.
Bastards, Joey sobbed, his shoulder against the quaking door. You're all no good bastards.
The sight of the old man, straining, pushing with all his might, was hideous. Green was ripping out the rotted wood below the counter.
Leave him alone,
Norm yelled, amazed to find himself trying to pull Whitey Martin away from the door. But the huge man just pushed him aside.
Don't make it worse, Whitey warned. He's an old man. He's not hurting anybody.
He was yelling when Green grabbed his arm and spun him around.
You're fired. You hear me, Fermoyle? You're done. Dead. Get out of here,
Green said with a shove that sent him skidding.
You son of a bitch,
he bellowed, with a lunge that knocked Green to the ground. There were no blows thrown, just grunting and wrestling as Green tried to free himself.
Get off him, you stupid shit,
barked Kenny, as he and Jessing yanked him to his feet.
Call the police. Somebody call the police,
Green screamed.
What are you, nuts?
Kenny said, pushing him back as he strained to get to Green again.
He can't do that,
Norm panted.
He's the boss, and he can do whatever the hell he wants, kid. He's an asshole, he called over Kenny's shoulder. A pompous little asshole. Jesus Christ, you don't get it, do you?
Kenny growled, grabbing his arm.
Just get the hell out of here.
He couldn't believe it. They were getting their tools out of the trucks. Whitey Martin had his arm on Green's shoulder, placating him in a low, anxious voice. Green gestured toward Norm.
Aw, he's just a fuck-up like his old man,
Martin said. Charlie Rideros had climbed over the counter and was trying to get Joey out of the stand. Kenny picked up Green's crowbar and began to tear the metal sheeting from the roof. None of the men would look at Norm. His eyes boiled with tears. As he hurried down the hill, all he could hear was the wrenching of boards and the thud of impact as they were thrown faster and faster into the truck. He kept kicking the same stone along the sidewalk. Just a fuck-up like his old man. But at least he'd tried. He was sick of cowards and looking the other way and always turning the other fucking cheek. He ran, then kicked the stone so hard it flew from sight. He kept running. Everything had gotten so goddamn weird. He thought of his mother giggling at Duval's jokes, then sobbing in the bathroom when he didn't come. Benji and all his weird little secrets, and Alice slipping from room to room, afraid to show her face. They were trapped, and he would not be. He would not be trapped. Never again would he be called Sam Fermoyle's fuck-up son. He looked up, startled to see the mountains. The goddamn mountains, he thought, suddenly overwhelmed by this need to rid himself of her, of all of them, to be as sisterless and brotherless and motherless as he had been for the last 10 of his 16 years, fatherless. He darted out between two cars, and horns tooted as he ran across the street. He paused at the post office, then turned and ran down the alley behind the fruit store. There it was, Duval's Cadillac. He was up there again. Overhead, the dismal curtained windows reflected the fire escape of the opposite asphalt-sided building. He kicked a large rock by the cellar door until it was dislodged. It was heavy, but as he reared back, he was tall enough and strong enough to hurl it sailing, sailing, right straight through the shattering glass of Bernadette's window. He left the alley at a deliberate pace. He would not run nor hesitate. From now on, this was how it would be. As people approached, he hailed those he recognized in a sure voice, whether they acknowledged him or not. And to all the rest he called, "Hello! Hi there! How you doing? Beautiful day, isn't it?" Even though the sky had thickened to a mass of white clouds, so dense there was no sun. It was the day her mother had been waiting for, the day the soap was coming. Even though it was Saturday, her mother was dressed in her office clothes, skirt and blouse. Her dark hair waved back from her face. She wore bright red lipstick, and she couldn't stop smiling. Every time a car came up the street, she ran to the window. Alice had just set up the ironing board. This was her first night back at work. Her mother had talked Coughlin into taking her back. She told him Alice had been sick. "Which you have been," she said when she hung up. "You've been sick, and now you're better." Just like that. Smile, and it goes away. Smile, and no one knows. Alice wet her finger and touched the iron. She heard the hiss but felt nothing, which was the only way she could do it, pass in the glare of their headlights with them calling out to her, hiding their trays, yanking her apron strings, so many ugly things and people reaching out to drag their fingers through her insides, mingling their foulness with hers. She ran the iron lightly over the black nylon pants. The steam smelled of Joe. No, not him, not soap or school or anything. Better grayness without love or pain or shame, with only this dull tightness at the back of her brain, like an old impacted tooth. "What time is it?" Norm hollered into the kitchen again. They were supposed to help unload the truck. 3, Benji told him. He went back into the living room. 3? When's it coming?" Norm called. "I've been sitting here all day waiting." "You can keep on waiting," her mother called, "because you're not going anywhere." He had been grounded ever since Jardin Green's call to say Norm had assaulted him. "Hey, Mom, what do you think happened?" Norm said, coming into the kitchen. "You think maybe he got lost or something?" He didn't even try to hide his pleasure. "He's just held up somewhere. Business is like that. There's always a catch somewhere along the line." "What if he doesn't come?" Norm asked. "If he's held up much longer, I'm sure he'll call," her mother said. "No, I mean, what if he takes off? What if he doesn't ever come?" He stared at her. She tried to laugh. "Well, why would he do that? You know this isn't just my big opportunity, Norm. It's Omar's, too. I mean, the man has spent how many weeks, months now on this, so he's not about to just let the whole thing fall apart." "Why not? He's got your money. What else does he need?" She looked startled. "It's not just the money, Norm." She got up and went to the window again. "Omar and I, we're thinking about getting married."
"What?"
Norm gasped. "You heard me," her mother said. Alice was folding up the ironing board. She could feel her brother's eyes on her, but he was there and she was here. She could not be part of it. She unplugged the cord and bound it around the iron tightly, every movement spare and controlled, breath, even thoughts issuing in measured segments. "Don't yell, don't fight, not now with the veil so thin." There was rumbling out on the street. A large white panel truck was backing into the driveway. "It's here," her mother called over the window rattling roar. "It's here." Turning in a little circle, she ran her fingers through her hair, then daintily wiped the corners of her mouth. She tucked in her blouse, tugged her skirt straight.
"Yeah, but they're in Klubach's driveway," Benji called from the back hall door.
"Klubach's driveway," her mother repeated, stupefied. She hurried to the window.
"Mr. Klubach's opening his garage doors. There's some guy with Omar." Benji leaned farther out.
It's that Hood Mooney.
What's he doing? Her mother asked in a faint voice as she watched Omar and Mooney pass cartons down from the back of the truck to Harvey Klubach, who carried them into his garage.
He said he wouldn't sell it to them. I can't believe he's doing this.
Alice couldn't believe it either. Not him. Not Mooney. Not now, on top of everything else. It was almost funny, really. Her life was turning into a crazy newsreel with everyone moving too fast and speaking in high-pitched, scratchy voices. How had Mooney ended up with Omar? Any minute now, Joe would show up with Nora Hines and the Monsignor. Her father would stagger down the street with his arm around Anthology Carper. Mr. Coughlin and Lester would pull in on Mooney's motorcycle. Norm would be punching Harvey Klubach while Jesse screamed at Alice to do something, anything, but don't just stand there. The truck had pulled out of Klubach's driveway and was backing into theirs. Her mother told Norm and Benji to go out and help unload the soap. At the door, Norm paused and seemed to flex his entire body. Omar winked at Alice as he came into the kitchen. He carried three red roses wrapped in tinfoil.
The day has finally come, he said, holding them out to her mother.
How could you do that?
She asked, ignoring the flowers. She couldn't believe he had sold a franchise to Harvey Klubach after assuring her he wouldn't. What was he thinking of? Two franchisers living side by side, selling the exact same products?
A franchise?
He seemed bewildered. Then his eyes widened.
Oh, no. No, no, no. Harvey's just going to be a kind of warehouse man for me. This way I won't have to keep running to Connecticut every time a franchiser needs restocking. It's a favor.
She looked out the window. I don't want any favors from those Klubachs. I know how that goes.
Actually, it's not really a favor, he confided. I'm paying half rent.
Rent? How much? He touched her cheek.
Marie, what do I keep telling you? Some things you just have to leave up to me, like the Klubachs, for instance.
He looked over at Alice.
There's a young man out there's been asking me all about you, he said, grinning.
She turned and went upstairs to dress. When she came down, her mother was outside with Omar. Alice looked out the window. Mooney worked from the back of the truck, sliding cartons along the ramp he had fashioned from two planks. Norm and Benji ran back and forth, carrying cartons into the garage. Mooney kept glancing at the house. She went to the front door. If she slipped out this way, he might not see her. She shut the door quickly when she saw so many of the neighbors out there, the busy Bartleys, the Branches from across the street, the Wilbers and Mrs. Rose, the cheeriest woman in the neighborhood, were all standing in front of the house. Nervous little Mrs. Merton was being pulled along by her dachshund, straining on its leash toward the Bartleys. Little Bobby Rose was pedaling his tricycle toward the gathering. Trapped, she went to the kitchen window. Omar was giving some kind of a speech out there. Mr. Klubach had come to the edge of the driveway. The young couple who always played badminton on their front lawn stood beside him. All were careful to stay on the Klubach's side. Up on her back porch, Jessie Klubach was wiping a pot lid over and over with a red dish towel. Lewis sat a step below her.
Right now, Omar was saying, I'll bet you're all wondering, did Tide start this way? Did Rinso start this way? Did Cheer and Fab and Ivory Flakes? I know I always wondered. And guess what? The answer is yes, yes, yes.
Her mother's face was red. Her hands fluttered around her throat. Alice could tell by the way she stared at Omar that she was as proud as she was self-conscious.
All giants have small beginnings, humble commencements, he continued.
Mr. Klubach, Mrs. Rose, and the young couple were on the Fermoil side of the driveway now. Bobby Rose came pedaling into the backyard. Louis Klubach bounded across the yards to join him. Together they ran alongside Benji as he worked.
Of course they did, Omar said with a clap of his hands. And the product we offer is such as theirs. Purity, cleanliness, spotlessness, neat and tidy lives, if you'll overlook my cheery pun, my fabulous play on word flakes.
Everyone chuckled. Ginny and stern Edgar Bartley, who had not spoken to Marie, nor she to them, for 3 years, were halfway down the driveway now. Mrs. Rose followed with Mrs. Merton. The dachshund kept circling her until the leash had wrapped around her legs. Omar grinned, and with his sleeve blotted the sweat trickling into his eyes.
He held out a plastic bottle of frothy pink liquid to them on the heel of his hand.
Here it is, the magic liquid, the elixir of lustration. It will dry clean.
His fingers snapped the bottle with each claim.
It will fumigate. It will disinfect. It will sanitize. It will be found in every toilet bowl, every shower stall, every sink and laundry room of America, because...
He leaned forward and crooned hoarsely, so softly even Marie strained to hear.
Because this is more than just a bottle of soap. This is opportunity and freedom that's come to Edgewood Street.
If she waited much longer, she'd be late for work. She opened the front door and hurried down the walk. None of the neighbors saw her because they were all facing Omar. She started down the road.
Alice!
Omar called, gesturing as everyone turned. She gave a little wave, but he kept calling her name and insisting she come back and speak with this young man. Bare-chested, Blue Mooney sauntered around from the back of the truck.
Alice, come say hello to Mr. Blue Mooney here,
he said as she came back to the head of the driveway.
A fine young man, if ever there was one,
he said, thumping Mooney's back. With the notorious name, a hush fell over the neighbors.
Hi, Alice,
Mooney smiled.
How are you doing?
Face red, all she could do was nod.
Blue was hoping you'd be here,
Omar said. I'm late. I have to go, she told Omar. She saw Mooney stiffen.
Well then, this just works out so fine,
Omar said as Norm and Benji emerged from the garage.
Blue will give you a ride in his handsome white truck that now stands empty and idle. Sure,
said Mooney. He grabbed his shirt and ran to open the door for her. The neighbors formed a little cluster around Mr. Klubach and Jessie, who had come down from the porch. She knew they were talking about her, trampy little Alice Vermoyle. Look what she'd come to, my God, the town hood with a full moon tattooed on his back. She tried to tell Omar that she wanted to walk. She needed to walk. She stepped closer to tell her mother she didn't want to go with him. Go, Marie ordered through a clenched smile. Just go, now. Her mother wanted the spectacle to end, wanted the neighbors to leave, wanted Omar to stop passing out bottles of Presto soap to everyone. Mom, Norm said, looking at Alice, I'll give her a ride. In what? She snapped, the smile now trembling. Go. Just go. As they drove off, Alice stared down at her folded hands. Her feet were close together on the mat. Her hair fell forward onto her face. Mooney drove slowly.
That Duval's something, huh?
Mm, she nodded. The slower he went, the more nervous she became, and yet the closer she got to the A plus X, now the more her heart began to pound. She was short of breath. She felt so light-headed that she was afraid she might faint. She was drifting, and his deep voice was something to focus on.
I just met him, and you'd think we were best friends or something.
He kept looking over at her.
He knows so much about things. Everything you mention, he's seen it or done it or been there.
He's an entrepreneur, she said, swallowing hard.
Huh?
Said Mooney.
He told me he was a salesman.
She pretended to look out the side window, but her eyes were closed.
You're awful quiet,
he cleared his throat.
I said, you're awful quiet.
I'm late.
You still got a few minutes.
She turned to see him biting his lip. No, I don't. I should be there right now.
Look, I just want to talk, okay?
He said, turning the wheel sharply. He pulled onto a narrow road through a wooded lot off Main Street. He parked, letting the engine idle.
You heard what happened, right? I know you did, you must have. Everyone else did. I got a real raw deal, but you want to know something funny? The whole time I was there, it never really got to me because then I'd get bitter, you know? Real mad. But then this other thing kept happening. All of a sudden, I'd be thinking of things, nice things, like seeing you up at work and talking to you, and the night I walked you home, and that night at the lake, graduation night.
Her eyes were closed, and she covered her mouth to hold all these pieces together, to keep from laughing or crying, or both. The crazy film was playing again. The pieces were falling. Her head was made of wooden blocks that kept falling into her lap. How had she gotten here? How had any of this happened?
And then the rest of it didn't seem so bad.
He sighed.
Alice?
He sighed again, then cleared his throat.
I'm starting to feel like a real jerk here.
He laughed nervously.
Oh, boy, this is turning into a real mess, isn't it?
I have to go to work, she said.
Will you talk to me, Alice?
He begged, almost groaning.
Please, please talk to me. Try. Just give me a chance, please. You think I'm a loser, but I'm not. You don't know the first thing about me. Jesus!
He banged the wheel, and the thud through the shaft seemed to vibrate in her head.
I don't get it. I just don't get it. You not only won't talk to me, but you don't even care how it makes me feel. Hey, what have I got? Jackass written across my chest or something? You just sit there. You're like everybody else. You don't think I'm worth shit. I'm just here, right? This creep you don't even have to look at, much less speak to.
I'm sorry, she whispered. But there wasn't a thing she could think of to say. She had too little energy and no desire to help him. He was staring so hard she tried to smile. Suddenly she was laughing. She covered her face to hide it.
Hey, no problem, he said with a bitter laugh.
He backed down the road so fast he had to jam on the brakes to turn.
I get the point, he called as the truck rattled up Main Street. I'm a whole other species from you, or so you think. But I got news for you, you stuck-up little bitch. I'm just as good as you, and I'm just as smart as you.
He tore into the A+X lot, which was already starting to get busy. He drummed his fingers on the wheel, then looked at her when she didn't move.
So go ahead, get the hell out of here. That's what you want, isn't it?
I'm, she tried to say, but she couldn't stop making this hideous sound.
Get out! Just get out!
He roared. A car pulled in and idled behind them. They were blocking the entrance. The car tooted once, then twice. Mooney jerked his arm out the window, gesturing for it to wait.
What? You don't want to get out?
He watched her. She wanted to die. That's what she wanted, to shrivel up and die. She closed her eyes.
You want me to pull over?
Now the driver behind them leaned on the horn, the close blaring like a drill on a nerve. She opened the door and was climbing down when Coughlin's office door flew open. Enraged, he tore across the lot, cursing and waving his arms for the truck to move and the car to kill the horn.
I don't need this, he yelled. Move it! Move it! Move it!
Seeing it was Alice, he grabbed her apron from her hand and held it up as if it were evidence of something.
First aid back and you're late. Shut up, Coughlin,
Mooney called from the loudly idling truck. He peered at her.
You think it's funny? I don't need this. I'm not putting up with it, you hear me? I'm not putting up with it from you or anyone else. Don't be stupid, Coughlin. Leave her alone,
Mooney warned. Coughlin pointed up at him.
You! You get the fuck out of here, you hear me?
Waitresses paused with their trays to watch. Drivers stared from their cars. The horn had stopped. She started to walk away, but he yanked her back and whipped the apron at her.
You're here. You work.
Mooney had jumped out of the truck.
You son of a bitch,
he yelled, grabbing Coughlin and spinning him around.
I said leave her alone.
He shoved Coughlin, and the skinny man reeled backward, then tripped and went down on one knee. Whistling and cheering erupted from the cars, and now all the horns were honking. Alice tried to cover her face, but Mooney was hurrying her back to the truck.
I'm sorry, she said as they pulled out of the lot. I'm so sorry.
You don't have anything to be sorry for, believe me. Not you, Alice.
It was Sunday. In the middle of the table was Marie's engagement ring. The big day had come and gone, and here she sat, trembling and alone. Because Omar had never paid her loan, she was 2 months behind, and Alice was supposed to start school soon. She didn't have a car, both of her children had been fired from their jobs, and she'd just found out that Harvey Klubach was a franchiser. This morning she'd seen three neighbors coming out of Klubach's garage with king-size boxes of laundry detergent. Thinking it was her soap those nervy Klubachs were either selling or giving away, she'd called Jesse and demanded to know what the hell was going on. Jesse had been shocked to find out that Marie was also a franchiser. Omar had told them that he was using Marie's garage for storage space. As the back door squealed open, she folded her arms to hide the trembling. Omar came in and sank into the chair across from her. He looked at the ring.
Why did you lie to me about the Klubach soap?
I didn't lie,
he insisted. Of course he had. Lied all along and right up to the very moment of delivery had lied. And if he would not admit it now, then he must be disturbed.
There had to be something terribly wrong with a man who not only lied, but had to have known when he told the lie that he would be found out. He hung his head and tried to explain that he hadn't thought of it as lying. He had only wanted to help Harvey Klubach.
But by helping him, you hurt me.
But that's not the way I was looking at it, he said.
Oh, really?
Well, it seems pretty obvious to me that two people right next door to each other selling the exact same product are going to be competing for the same customers. It seems like a pretty basic concept, doesn't it? Doesn't it? She demanded.
Eyes closed. He nodded.
He had deliberately misled her, she told him. He had used her, had taken her good faith and trust and made a fool out of her in front of her children.
And that is the worst thing you could have done to me, she cried, hitting the table.
You don't understand, he whispered.
But now she finally did. She pushed the ring across the table. He had gotten all the money from her he was ever going to get, and now it was over. She didn't feel sad or even angry, just curiously quiet, still. She would find a way out of this mess, even if it meant knocking on every door in town or setting up a roadside stand somewhere. She would get a second job if she had to. Nothing, and no one, and certainly no man, would ever again threaten her children's future. He had not meant to deceive her, had not intended it.
But you see, he tried to go on, you see,
he buried his face in his hands.
If you have any of my money, I want it back, she said.
All he had, after paying for the truck and the driver, was this. He put the bills on the table. She counted $21 bills.
Thank you,
she said with a bitter laugh. She stood up.
Marie,
he cried.
Help me. Please help me.
There were tears running down his cheeks. He had only wanted to help Harvey, he sobbed, and she was right, of course. What he had done made no sense. In fact, it was perfectly bizarre. But that was how he always got into trouble, by making promises and telling himself he would deal with it all later, by wanting so badly to please everyone that once again he had ended up ruining his own chance for happiness. It had been the same with his road crew. He had been so good, so generous to them, that they ended up wanting all the money and all the inventory for themselves. She was shocked at how frail he seemed, and for such a sophisticated man, how perilously innocent. She sat back down and tried to make him see how ruthless people could be. The more they were given, the more they wanted.
I know that,
he said.
But knowing and doing
have never been the same thing for me. It's a curse, a terrible, terrible curse.
You promise too much. You give too much of yourself, Omar.
I know.
Look at you. You're a wreck. Your clothes are all wrinkled and dirty. You've got dark circles under your eyes.
It was that late run to Connecticut. Just like you said, it turned out to be a total waste of time. I don't know what's wrong with me. I have all these great ideas, all this energy and ambition, but I never seem to get anywhere.
Because you bite off more than you can chew, Omar.
But why? Why do I do that?
He asked, gripping the table edge.
Because you don't have a family to consider before you make decisions.
You're right. You are so very right, he said.
And then for a few moments, neither one of them spoke.
Don't send me away, Marie. Please don't.
He reached for her hand and eased the ring back onto her finger. She would not have to sell soap door to door or set up a roadside stand. He would, he told her. He would. He couldn't bear the thought of being alone, of going on without her.
Marry me tomorrow, he begged.
Tonight, right now, please.
Yes, but they would have to wait. There were the license and the blood test. And though she did not say it, she had to tell Sam. For the last two mornings, Omar had driven off with his trunk loaded with soap that he was selling door to door along every back road he could find. Again tonight, Marie had been amazed to see his empty trunk.
They're selling like hotcakes,
he said over the armload of Presto laundry powder boxes he was packing into his trunk for tomorrow's route.
Yeah, I'll bet,
Norm said to Benji in the garage. He's probably dumping them someplace. Norm picked up six of the boxes.
Oh, no, Benji said. He is. He's selling them.
Jesus, I can't believe you're still falling for his crap.
He shoved the boxes into Benji's arms.
He is, Norm. I saw all the money. He showed Mom.
At that, Norm kicked one of the boxes, puncturing it,
A stream of white granules gushed onto the floor. Benji tried to hurry outside, but Norm pulled him back. He brought his face close to his brother's. "Am I the only one? Don't you see? Can't you feel it?" he hissed. "What?" Benji whispered. "The disaster that's coming." Benji swallowed hard. "What do you mean?"
"Well, for one thing, them getting married," Norm said, annoyed by the relief on his brother's face. "Don't you see? It's going to be a total disaster."
"Oh,"
was Benji's only response. They both looked toward the door as Marie called for them to bring more soap out. "There's got to be something she'll listen to. Everything I say she's got an answer for. I mean, I could tell her he's wanted for murder, and she'd say, 'Oh, no, you don't understand. It wasn't really murder. It was just a little business thing, that's all.'"
Marie called in again. "What are you two doing in there, making the soap?"
She and Omar laughed.
"What do you mean, wanted for murder?" Benji asked.
He looked toward the driveway. "I mean, she's getting just like him, twisting the facts to fit the way she wants things to be. That's how desperate she is, because nothing fits together. Nothing's real."
"What do you mean?"
"I mean him. Duval, he's not real."
Just then the garage darkened as Duval stepped into the doorway, blocking the setting sun.
"Don't tell me I've stumbled into some kind of brotherly conspiracy here,"
he said, laughing, and a chill went through Norm to see the cold fix of Duval's eyes on Benji before he hurried outside. Duval picked up a carton of soap bottles and started for the door.
"Come on now, your mother's waiting."
He grinned, then added,
"Son."
Norm watched the three of them pushing cartons into Duval's trunk. Alice had gone to the lake to spend a few days with her girlfriend Mary Agnes. Without her, he had the sensation of being the outsider, a stranger this family had to humor but found threatening. How long had it been like this, the three of them standing so close, the quick hand on an arm, the wordless amusement of intimates? Seeing them this way through the garage door, framed by hazy shadows and the weathered beams, he felt the same compelling contradiction of tension and distance as if he were watching a movie. Nothing was real, and yet anything could happen. Anything, at any moment, and there would be nothing he could do.
"Let them believe his lies,"
he thought, picking up the punctured soapbox and hurling it in a spray of white powder across the garage.
"Let them be destroyed, but not me,"
he vowed, hurrying outside and realizing as he bore down on them that he enjoyed their fear and apprehension. He had become the spoiler, a force to be reckoned with. Later that night, Weeb pulled up outside and honked the horn. It was Weeb's first night out since he'd had his casts removed. Norm was halfway out the door when Marie insisted he take his brother along. Benji didn't want to go, but she was adamant, and he knew by the way she and Omar did not once look at each other the reason for Benji's eviction. It was his first night out with Weeb in almost 2 months. It was a relief being able to burst into hysterical laughter at the sight of Myrna Merganser in an orange dress, arm in arm with her boyfriend Freddy, their beefy hips and thighs grazing with every waddling step.
"Toodle!"
Weeb cried, and Norm collapsed against the dashboard with tears running down his cheeks.
"What's toodle mean?" Benji asked, leaning over the seat.
It means,
oh shit, you tell him," Weeb gasped.
"I can't. Oh, shit, I can't,"
Norm squealed. It was too complicated, too dirty and dumb, so long between them that it had come to mean just about anything. A few minutes later, he asked Weeb the question that had been on his mind for days.
"Has your sister gone back to college yet?"
"School," Weeb corrected him. "You don't say college. That's taken for granted."
"Oh, okay, Weeb.
Well, you don't want to sound like a jerk, do you?"
"So, did she go?"
he asked, rolling his eyes.
"She's not going back." "She's not?"
he cried so eagerly that Weeb looked at him.
"How come?"
"Make him sit back," Weeb said with a glance in the rearview mirror.
"Benji, sit back."
Benji sank low in the seat.
"How come?"
he asked again. As he spoke in a low voice, Weeb kept looking in the mirror. "She's gonna have a baby, so she has to get married to her boyfriend from college." "School," Norm wanted to say, but didn't. Janice Miller, whom he had secretly worshipped since first grade, would soon be a bride, a wife, a mother. They drove down Merchants Row. The stores were closed. They turned onto Center Street, where a line waited to get into the Paramount Theater. Weeb honked the horn, and a bunch of girls waved and gestured for them to come join them.
"Arf, arf!" we barked under his breath and drove on.
What'd your mother and father say?
My father didn't say anything. He just punched out all the windows in the garage. My mother had to take him to the hospital for stitches. He was shocked by Weeb's offhandedness. Of all the times his father had kicked in doors or been hauled off in a cruiser, he had never spoken of it to Weeb. There had always been this fragile duality, the devastating fear that everyone knew and the desperate need to believe that no one did.
He hasn't been to work all week. His hands are all bandaged. He just sits around playing his Glenn Miller records.
That's weird, huh?
Yeah, well, my mother's afraid he's having a nervous breakdown. Now he says he's going to quit his job. He says it was his work, that it was a bad influence, you know, sex and everything.
Can I sit up now? Benji called. I can't see.
Shut up,
Norm said, waving his arm over the seat. He looked at Weeb. Something had just occurred to him, a nagging pinprick of doubt and fear. Pain swelled in his chest as he recalled waking up in Klubach's garage with his pants undone.
Oh, jeez,
Weeb cried, as a pickup truck slowed to a stop beside them at the red light. It was Josie Amenka, snuggled so close to Grandine Carson that they both fit behind the steering wheel.
Let's go, Weeb hollered, turning when the light changed. It's egg run time!
They sped up the long dirt road to the untended pig farm where their only concern would be the barking dogs. But Weeb knew exactly how to do it. He pulled in so close to the chicken coops that they only had to jump from the car to the coop door. Benji had begged them not to come here, and now he refused to leave the car. He crouched low in the back seat, arms folded, eyes closed, lips moving as if he were praying. Inside the chicken coop, it was hot and quiet until Weeb turned on the light, and then all the chickens started squawking. Hundreds of them, Norm thought, coming down the narrow walkway between the nesting birds. Their heads rose and their bright sideways eyes gleamed nervously. The reek of shit and ammonia stung his eyes. An old hand at egg runs, Weeb went straight to the end of the coop, where the egg boxes were stacked on shelves. They took 10 boxes each, then ran back to the car, leaving the lights on in the coop and the door open.
Hey, you want to go to the wedding?
Weeb asked as they raced back to town.
No,
he said too quickly.
I can't. I got something else that day.
What do you mean? I didn't even tell you when it is yet. Weeb gave him a sour look.
When is it?
September the 16th, Weeb said. Come on, Norm. I'd do it for you. Norm looked at him. Did he mean Alice? Had he heard about her and the priest? He was getting paranoid.
Janice won't want me there.
I'll ask her, Weeb said, parking on Main Street across from the A plus X. They didn't have long to wait. As soon as Coughlin's office door opened, they pulled into the lot. The minute he stepped outside, Norm rose up through the open window and pelted him with a flurry of eggs. He sprinted after them with yolk running down his face and chest. But they were already gone, on their way to Jardin Green's house, then Kenny Doyle's, then Coach Graber's, Donna Kreller's, the Monsignor's gleaming Oldsmobile. Benji turned out to have the best in-flight arm. Splat, 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 no questions asked. Back behind the fruit store, splat, 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 right up at the cardboard taped in Bernadette's broken window. They drove down to the baseball field and left the car running with the lights on the infield. Weeb stood on the mound, egg cartons at his feet. Norm's bat was a fence picket. Benji sat on the hood, laughing and clapping every time Norm hit an egg. The impact sent shells and egg slime flying back at Weeb, but most of the mess covered Norm. It was disgusting, but strangely pleasurable, the sticky goo running down the bat between his fingers, down his wrists. It was dripping from his elbows, from his chin.
Miller is on the mound, Weeb continued, broadcasting every pitch. He gets the sign, sets, checks the runner, winds, and throws.
Norm swung and hit another one.
Jesus, Weeb, you're going to be great next year.
You too, Norm. You haven't missed one yet.
I'll show that fucking Graber.
He crouched even lower over the plate. Weeb fired it in, and he swung and missed. The egg flew into the dirt.
Car!
Benji yelled as headlights turned the corner. They jumped into the car and sped off. They drove home, and Benji went inside. Norm dragged the hose behind the garage. Weeb had gone first, and now it was Norm's turn. He stood against the back wall of the garage, his arms over his head, while Weeb blasted him with ice-cold water.
Okay,
Weeb called, his wet clothes plastered to his body.
I'm freezing.
No, Norm called softly. Keep going.
Shit,
Weeb groaned, moving closer. The full force of the water pelted his flesh like needles. His eyes smarted.
Jesus Christ, Norm, are you through? You gotta be clean now,
Weeb called, his teeth chattering.
No.
Are you through?
No,
he gasped, turning his head to answer. Each time the hose moved closer, and now Weeb was only a foot away. Norm was sobbing. Weeb dropped the hose, and the water gushed through the tall grass around Norm's feet.
That was weird, said Weeb, his wet pant legs slapping together as he started back to the car.
What do you mean?
Norm said, catching up with him. Now he was shivering.
I don't know, Weeb shrugged. It was just weird, that's all.
He got into the car.
What the hell do you mean?
Norm grabbed his arm, afraid Weeb knew he'd been crying.
Nothing, Norm.
Weeb looked up at him.
I didn't mean anything.
It was hot, and every seat at the 8 o'clock mass was filled. The dazzling stained glass windows were alive with light and heat. Flames danced under Christ's thin white feet. The slender Virgin Mary smiled coyly at the muscular angel Gabriel in his shimmering white gown. The Sacred Heart of Jesus pulsated with ruby blood, and saints trembled. Every door in the church had been left open, which only drew in the exhaust of passing automobiles and the racket of barking dogs. The sound of fluttering paper grew as men and women fanned themselves with parish bulletins that were read this week. There was a large, oscillating fan on the altar. Every time it turned toward the pulpit, Father Gannon's lacy surplice billowed and his voice rose, though he was as unaware of the brief respite as he was of the heat and his squirming flock's discomfort. There was coughing. Throats were cleared. Shoes shuffled and scraped on the dull oak floors. The sermon was now entering its 26th minute. At the rear of the church, ushers waited with their long-handled baskets poised. They kept looking at each other. If the parking lot wasn't cleared out by the 9 o'clock, there'd be a traffic jam out there, the likes of which they couldn't imagine. Father Gannon could see by the usher's grave expressions that he had plumbed some deep well of concern in them. He smiled and held out his arms. There was so much to share with these good people. He was past bitterness, though his heart was sore with loss.
No sparrow falls unseen, he said. No cry goes unheard. It is when we feel most alone, when we feel most forsaken, that we are surrounded by angels, millions of angels, hordes of angels.
Somewhere a baby began to cry. Their faces were a blur beyond the red flutter. He was telling them about the poor children he had tried to help. He told them about the rent strike, the hundreds of donated blankets, and now his voice broke as he shared the memory of the young woman and her dying infant, his tale all the more vivid with the baby's wails. They stared up at him over the red wings.
It does not have to be that way, he told them. We can stop that kind of suffering. Poverty is a man-made evil. God did not create some men rich and others poor. God does not allocate riches or misfortune. No, he creates all men equal. It is the choices we make that shape our destiny. This, he said a bit louder, this is the key, the crucial element in life, choice.
Hands on the pulpit rim, he drew a deep breath, and from the corner of his eye he was aware of an iridescent vapor shimmering in the sunlight through the open doorway at the side of the church. Howard was hosing down the Monsignor's egg-spattered car. And what were Howard's choices, he wondered? Had he been born with the same opportunity as everyone else? No. But God watched over such people. They were part of his greater design. But the injustice of this rose in his chest like sudden bile. In the front row, a woman coughed softly into the palm of her hand, and the sound seemed an explosion in the hush. Sweat rose on Father Gannon's back. He was stuck. There was no accounting for Howard. Because of him, nothing worked. Nothing was right or equitable. There had been Radlett. He tried now to explain the story of the sickly child and what it had meant, not so much for Radlett finally to have a warm jacket that was his own, brand new and not second-hand, but for him, the young curate, to have received so much by giving so little. He looked up. The two were connected, Radlett and Howard, but he could not find the key.
You see,
he tried to explain, sensing by the uneasy stir that he was losing them, not just their attention, but their faith.
There is giving of a higher order, that the giving of things can only prepare us for.
It is in the giving of oneself that we come closest to divine nature, to God's love.
Yes, this was the key element, for without love, what were any of them? What was he? But still there was the problem of Howard, who had to be more than a testing ground for their values. He began to tell them about love, all the kinds of love and reasons for love, and how, when he had nothing to give, he had given himself, and he would do it again and again, and in this giving he was sinless. This was the choice, he explained, truly the only one of importance, the choice to love or not to love. How simple, how pure.
And so it comes in the end to that.
He shaded his eyes and peered into the recesses of the church. The doorways were filling with people, so many latecomers just arriving. She would not be among them. She was afraid. She had not been ready to make the choice.
Come in. Come join us, he cried with an exultant wave. Don't be shy. Let's make room for one another here. Push in closer to one another, he exhorted those seated as the new arrivals started hesitantly down the aisles.
His altar boys whispered a moment. Then one, Harry, a tall boy, burst out laughing and could not stop. Father Gannon winked, and the boy covered his face with his hands. The sound of idling engines surrounded the church like buzzing around a hive. Patrick Muley, the head usher, made his way down the packed center aisle. Watching him approach, Father Gannon waited with outstretched arms,